Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the shocking confirmation that America's sick gun culture is fueled by gun manufacturers, in particular the makers of the Bushmaster assault rifle used in the recent massacre of schoolchildren. In an explicit ad campaign, Bushmaster ties manhood to using their assault rifle, issuing man cards to customers who buy this military weapon. Alex Seitz-Wald, Salon's Washington political reporter, joins us. He has two articles at Salon: Assault Rifle Company Issues Man Cards, and The Answer is Not More Guns. Then we'll look into rumors that President Obama might sell out on Social Security in the current negotiations on the so-called fiscal cliff. Robert Weissman, the president of the Washington, D.C.-based consumer watchdog group Public Citizen, joins us to discuss his concern that instead of taxing Wall Street, the White House might be ready to ship senior citizens down the river and start taxing grandma. Then finally, with hearings about to start in the Senate Armed Services Committee into the tragic resource war in the Congo, where 5 million have died so that we can get cheap components for consumer electronics, we will speak with a Congolese expert on who is profiting from the destruction of his country. George Zangola, professor of African Studies and Afro-American Studies at the University of North Carolina, joins us to discuss a much-needed change in U.S. policy towards the Congo. And joining us now is Alex Seitz-Wald, who is Salon's Washington political reporter. He was previously the deputy editor of thinkprogress.org, the blog for the Center for American Progress, and his latest articles at salon.com are The Answer is Not More Guns and Assault Rifle Company Issues Man Cards. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alex Seitz-Wald.
Thanks for having me.
So just starting with the article on the assault rifle company issuing man cards, I've been trying to make that point for the last few days talking to people on this issue, including Colin Goddard, who you quote in your other article, The Answer is Not More Guns. And here we have the proof. I mean, I'm grateful for you because I've been making the case, for example, I grew up in Australia, which is a different culture. And if you got into a fight with somebody in Australia and pulled a gun or a knife, you would be considered an abject coward and a disgrace. But in America, guns associated with heroism and manliness. And here's the proof. You've got the company, the very company that makes the assault rifle that killed all of those people in Connecticut, are issuing man cards.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. I mean, as you said, you know, this is an argument that liberals have been making for a long time about gun owners. But here you have Bushmaster, which is, you know, one of the largest gun makers. They make the AR-15 assault rifle that was used in the shooting, and also the one that was used in the Aurora, Colorado shooting, and in the one in Oregon just a few weeks ago, the Clackamas Mall. And they have an entire marketing campaign built around not being manly enough, and if you purchase one of their rifles, you will redeem your masculinity. And this is explicit. This isn't, you know, like a Budweiser commercial or other commercials where it's kind of hinting at if you buy their product, you'll be a man. This is explicitly saying, you know, they ask you a quiz on their website. Do you eat tofu? Do you watch figure skating? Do you know how to change the tire on your car? And if you answer no to any of those, they will revoke your man card and suggest, you know, maybe you can prove your manliness by buying one of our assault rifles. So it's pretty brazen and I think a little bit shocking, but it shouldn't be that surprising because this is very much part of the culture, as you said.
Well, I haven't noticed. You said liberals have been saying this for some time. I haven't noticed that that has been an argument against the proliferation of guns. I mean, a lot of the pathology and the psychology of these killers involved in these mass shootings, there is a consistency that they are young men and boys who feel rejected by their peers and are trying to prove something. And by picking up a gun and doing this, conducting these massacres, somehow that is a step towards more manliness. I mean, it's so embedded in the culture. It's embedded here in Hollywood, where I'm talking to you from. Every movie poster and every TV show features people poking guns out at you. And the consensus of the movie plots and the TV shows are that the guns solve the problems and the people who use them effectively are our heroes.
Right. And there's a fetishization of the gun, you know, not so much as something to be respected and feared and a tool that has a purpose, but that is also very dangerous. It's more, you know, like a sports car or like something that's just unquestionably cool and to be desired and you know, lusted after, really. And I think that's dangerous. I mean, the, when you look at the type of guns that, that we're talking about here, these assault rifles, they are military-style assault rifles, and they are specifically designed aesthetically to look like military weapons. I mean, the, one of the big conservative critiques of kind of legislation like the assault weapon ban is that there are plenty of guns that do the exact same thing that don't look like assault weapons, and that's a valid point. But it, it what it gets at is that these guns are explicitly designed to look like the kinds of things you see in movies and TV shows, and that's what people are you know, lusting after. And these kind of ad campaigns, the man card, plays directly into that, people wanting to act out their fantasies of, you know, being Rambo or a manly man. But it misses the point that these are, of course, terribly dangerous tools that, that, you know, need to be respected.
Well, but specifically, again, I'm speaking with Alex Seitz-Wald, who's Salon's Washington Political Reporter and previously was deputy editor of thinkprogress.org, the blog for the Center for American Progress, and he has two articles at salon.com. The answer is not more guns and assault rifle company issues man cards, which is what we're talking about at the moment. And these man cards actually exist. If you buy the Bushmaster, the very assault weapon that killed all of those children in Connecticut, you get one of these cards, and it says Bushmaster, and it says man card, and this certifies you are a man card holder. And on the back, it says rights and privileges. The bearer of this card has averted complete humiliation. Today, he is a man, fully entitled to all the rights and privileges duly afforded, to belch without apology, to leave the seat up without shame. The way is before you. And of course, as you mentioned, the questionnaire that goes along with getting a man card asks whether or not you eat tofu, can change a tire, have ever watched figure skating, whether you drink light beer. Your card can be revoked for offenses such as being a crybaby, a coward, a cupcake, having a short leash, presumably meaning that your wife or girlfriend has you on a leash, and being generally unmanly. So it couldn't be more clearer, the association that this gun manufacturer is trying to make with the product that they are trying to sell, that you've got to man up and get a Bushmaster.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of companies, this is not new, this kind of line of thinking. You see it in beer commercials and football ads and all kinds of stuff, but it's usually it's much less direct. I mean, this is really explicit. You know, you are not a man unless Bushmaster tells you you are a man. And I think that's dangerous, or that's at least something that we should be, you know, thinking about and concerned about in this larger debate about guns, which has been sparked by this awful tragedy. I think we need to look at the culture and not just the policy and not just mental health, but the way that guns are fetishized and the way that they, you know, for a lot of men in this country, are associated with masculinity and the only way to prove your worth as a man. I think that's something that really we need to take a hard look at.
So, Alex Seitz-Wald, just turning to your other article at salon.com, the answer is not more guns. You're quoting here Larry Pratt, who's executive director of Gun Owners of America. That's the even more right-wing organization than the NRA. They think the NRA are a bunch of pussies. And Pratt said over the weekend, after this massacre, yet another schoolhouse massacre, he said that gun control supporters have the blood of little children on their hands for preventing law-abiding citizens from bringing guns to school. And what we're seeing now, we may be in an alternative universe here on the liberal side of politics in America, but on the conservative side of politics in America, people believe what Larry Pratt is saying, and the gun manufacturers such as Bushmaster are pushing that line that... Well, actually, they're pushing a different line. They're more or less telling the supporters of assault rifles and gun collectors in this country that as a result of this tragedy in Connecticut, Obama's going to take away your guns, so you better get to the gun store right away and start buying an arsenal. That's what's going on in America.
Yeah, and Larry Pratt makes the argument bluntly and offensively, and it's easy to dismiss him, and there's lots of other conservatives. Louis Gohmert, congressman from Texas, made a similar argument on the House floor. But then, you know, there's a more nuanced argument out there in this kind of thought that more guns equals less crime. Jeff Goldberg wrote a 7,000-word essay in The Atlantic just this month that came out kind of by a fluke of timing, was published just a week before last week's shooting. And there's a small body of scientific academic research that's tried to make the same case, that more guns will lead to less crime. And there's sort of an intuitive logic to it. You know, if you were in the elementary school at Sandy Hook, or if you were in the theater in Aurora, wouldn't you want to have had a gun so you could defend yourself, so you could stop the mass, the shooter? But if you look at the sum total of the data out there, and I spoke with five of the country's most prominent gun violence researchers, delved very deeply into the data, and it's just absolutely clear from all the evidence out there, unequivocally, that is not the right solution. We have plenty of evidence showing that the more guns there are, the more violence there is. It's that simple. If you have a gun in your home, regardless of who you are, just the numbers show there's a threefold increase in the likelihood of homicide and a fivefold increase in the likelihood of suicide. Across states that have more guns have more violence. I mean, there's just a huge amount of scientific data out there to support that. So the problem with this thinking that if we only had armed citizens, and we're seeing out in a number of states across the country, lawmakers introducing bills to either allow people to bring their concealed weapons into schools or to even arm teachers, you know, to create new programs to arm teachers. The problem is, while that would maybe be useful in a shooting situation, and I would argue that it's not, there's plenty of evidence to show that too, but you have to think about what happens to that gun the rest of the time when there's not a shooting going on, and it's a gun that's sitting there that could be found by a child and accidentally used, or could be used someone who is, you know, feeling is unstable and suicidal, or could be used by somebody who wants to commit a shooting but didn't have access to a gun. So I think this kind of line of thinking is really dangerous, and there's just an overwhelming amount of evidence that shows that it's not the right solution.
Again, I'm speaking with Alex Seitz-Wald, who's Salon's Washington political reporter. He has two articles at salon.com. The answer is not more guns, and the assault rifle company issues man cards. Now, the White House has come out saying that the president is going to vigorously pursue the reintroduction of the assault weapons ban that presumably Senator Feinstein is going to reintroduce. It was allowed to expire in the George W. Bush administration in 2004. It was only in place for 10 years. So that's happening on the one hand. But the point I was making, Alex, is that there is currently in this country a run on guns. People are going to gun stores and buying. The things are flying off the shelves. And the gun manufacturers are feeding that paranoia, saying that because of this shooting, Obama's going to take away your guns. Well, we know, I think you're in Washington. Surely if Obama and Dianne Feinstein do the heaviest lifting they're capable of, nothing's going to happen. The House is never going to pass any meaningful gun control. So meanwhile, there's a run on guns, and politically, you know, it looks like posturing. Maybe I'm too cynical, but tell me I'm not.
Well, unfortunately, I think you're right about the outcome. I mean, I don't think the House will ever pass an assault weapon ban, and that just shows you how far we've gone on this issue. You know, this is something that passed overwhelmingly in 1994 and then expired in 2004, and there hasn't even been any meaningful attempts to renew it. Even Democrats are afraid to bring it up. But I don't think it's entirely meaningless that Obama has come out for it and that Dianne Feinstein and other Democrats are pushing legislation. I think that is a step in the right direction for people who are concerned about assault weapons being on the street. And if you look at the polling, that's about 60% of Americans who say that we should ban these kinds of weapons. It's positive in that Democrats have been afraid to discuss it. Obama has completely ignored the gun control debate. It was not at all a part of his campaign this time around, a very small part in 2008, but you'll remember he got in trouble for saying that people cling to their guns and religion. And after that, he avoided talking about guns at all costs. The only bill of any significance that he signed that had to deal with guns was to expand gun rights access that allows you to carry a gun in a national park. So the fact that he's now coming out for this, it's not huge, but it's a step in the right direction. And I think as time goes on, if people remain outraged about this, and people continue to put pressure on him, I think there's a chance that if something can't be done through Congress, at least through the administration, there might be some, around the edges, some positive movement.
Well, at the very least, one would hope that the president does what he can to undo the very bill that he signed, allowing firearms in national parks. The governor of Michigan had just passed the Right to Work bill, which the president characterizes the Right to Work for Less bill. He has right on his desk a bill that would allow guns to be carried in schools and in churches and other public places. That's a model piece of legislation that ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, along with the NRA, have been pushing around the country, these conceal and carry laws and allowing guns into churches, schools, and other public buildings, such as hospitals. Again, you know, you have to ask yourself the question, Alex. I mean, the arguments that the gun rights advocates, if you will, call themselves, the pro-gun people, are making is that more guns lead to less crime. Well, if that's the case, America, with its 300 million guns, should be the safest place on the earth.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. And it's just not true. And we have, you know, an overwhelming amount of evidence, as I discussed, to show that that's simply not the case. And in fact, the more guns we have, the more dangerous we are. And the just looking at the case of the fact that we have 300,000 guns and we have
300
away,
million guns,
you know, seven times the homicide rate,
right,
and whatnot of other industrialized developed countries. So it's clearly not the answer. One bit of positive news, Rick Snyder, the governor of Michigan, came out this afternoon and he said that he will veto that law or that bill to allow teachers, allow people to bring schools in, excuse me, bring guns in schools. But, you know, I wonder if this is just in the week after the shooting, if people are paying attention to it. I'm afraid that as we go on, as new things come up, we'll lose focus on this issue and it will once again fade into the back burner and there will be nothing done on it.
Well, thank you for updating us on that, Alex. I wasn't aware that he'd actually vetoed that. I thought he was about to sign it, but obviously it's not a particularly politically astute move to sign a bill like that in a moment like this. But your article at Salon.com, Alex Seiswald, "The Answer Is Not More Guns. A Trendy Argument Suggests We'll Be Safer If More People Carry Guns. It's Dangerous, Wrong, and Terrible Policy." Some of the evidence that you've collected about how counterintuitive is the idea that that you need more guns to prevent these massacres. I didn't realize this, but apparently in the confusion over the shooting of the former congresswoman in Arizona, Representative Gabrielle Giffords, an armed citizen nearly shot the unarmed hero who tackled the shooter, Jared Loughner. So what we're really talking about here is bringing more guns to the party and the Wild West, and bullets will be flying everywhere.
Yeah, that's right, Ian. The unarmed man tackled Loughner, and he was using Loughner's gun to subdue him. You know, he was standing over him. There was a bunch of people there, but he had the gun in his hand. And when the armed citizen showed up, he saw a guy with a gun, and he pulled his own trigger. He pulled his own weapon, and he said he was about to pull the trigger, but he hesitated for a brief second, and then people started yelling, and he realized what was going on. But, I mean, it was split seconds away from shooting the innocent person, the hero who tackled Jared Loughner. And another bit of anecdotal evidence that suggests that not only can they be counterproductive, but they're not very useful. In the shooting in the mall in Oregon, there was a perfect example of what the gun rights people are saying should happen. There was a guy with a concealed weapons permit. He was within range of the shooter. The shooter was distracted, reloading his gun. The man ducked behind a column. He pulled out his weapon. He turned the corner. He saw the shooter very clearly. He said he could have taken a shot. But then he saw another woman behind the shooter, and he was afraid that if he shot at the shooter, he would hit this woman. So he decided not to fire, and he said he never regretted that. And that's exactly right. I mean, this is the problem. Imagine in the theater in Aurora, it's dark, there's smoke, there's people everywhere. If somebody had a gun there and tried to shoot at the shooter, almost inevitably, they would have hit somebody else. So it just doesn't make any sense if you actually sit down and think about it and work through the thought experiment. To bring more guns to the party is not the answer.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the reason why police are trained and why the military are trained, is for that very reason, that guns and bullets fly and There's always somebody in the background. It's just so irresponsible, I think, for so many people to be trying to exploit this tragedy to actually make arguments for more guns. But I think there's nothing more obscene than the gun manufacturers themselves, particularly this Bushmaster company that's putting out this man card and telling you you're not a man if you don't own a Bushmaster. They're all exploiting the current tragedy to get people to go to gun stores and buy more of their product on the basis that Obama's going to take away their guns, which we know is not going to happen. So I'm sorry that I'm sounding frustrated, but I just find this whole thing insane. And this country is the only one in the world that seems to tolerate this insanity. In the developed world, I should say, you know.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, I think it's a fair place to be insane or to feel insane. And if you look at the polling, I mean, there is a huge gun culture. We do love guns in this country. That's undeniable. But the policy where we are now is far to the right of where the public is. The public favors a ban on assault weapons. The public favors a ban on high-capacity magazines, which are like the one that the shooter in Aurora, Colorado used that can hold up to 100 bullets in one magazine without reloading. They favor background checks on every gun purchase. A lot of people don't know this, but if you go to a gun show or if you buy a gun at a private seller, you don't need to pass a background check. There's no record of the transaction, and that's how 40% of guns in this country are purchased. They also favor micro-stamping, which would help police track down guns that were used in crimes. So these are a lot of kind of common sense pieces of legislation that should really not be controversial at all, but the public supports them. But because this very small, very, very powerful gun lobby has been so effective in scaring politicians, they have been able to distort the policy to make it not reflect what the American people actually want.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Alex Seitzwald.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Alex Seitzwald, who is Salon's Washington political reporter. He was previously the deputy editor of thinkprogress.org, the blog for the Center for American Progress. And his latest articles at salon.com are "The Answer is Not More Guns" and "Assault Rifle Company Issues Man Cards." We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back and look into rumors that the Obama administration might cave on Social Security. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Weisman, who's the president of Public Citizen, a long-serving Washington consumer advocacy group. He's expert on economics, healthcare, trade, and globalization, intellectual property, and regulatory policy, and issues related to financial accountability and corporate responsibility. He has worked to lower pharmacy prices for AIDS victims and others in the developing world, and his top priorities include climate change, healthcare reform, financial regulation, and campaign finance. Reform. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Weisman.
Great to be back with you.
And what are the basis of this concern that's being expressed now by a lot of progressives in Washington that the White House is about to sell out on Social Security? What's the firm evidence here?
Well, we really don't know what's being negotiated or being proposed in the negotiations, but there are a lot of reports indicating that the administration is offering a stealth cut to Social Security in exchange for concessions from Republicans.
And this is to re-index Social Security. That's the plan, or at least that's the leak that's involved here and that's
right.
Got people concerned.
If the reports are right, they would change the way the cost of living index is calculated so that the annual inflation adjustment would be less than it currently is. And that seems technical and hard to understand, but people get that their Social Security is rising 3% or whatever it is a year to make up for inflation. If they don't get that, they're actually losing ground. Well, if you reduce the amount of increase, you're going to cost people money. And if you do that year after year after year, which would happen under the proposal, it starts to be a very significant effect on overall benefits over the medium and long term.
So if the White House is heading in this direction, why haven't they listened to what Bernie Sanders and others have been saying for the longest time, which is the simplest way to fix Social Security is to have the wealthy who basically get it for free, in effect. Why don't they pay a little bit more than the average people who really need this money? They need every cent of it, most people who collect Social Security.
Well, it's very hard for me to explain what the psychology or political calculus might be. And hopefully the reports are wrong, or hopefully there's something that they were floating and they're going to get enough pushback and they will drop. It is a really horrible idea that will have the most significant impact on some of the most vulnerable among us, on lower income elderly. What the administration had been saying in the past several weeks is that Social Security will not be part of any deal around the fiscal cliff, that negotiations over Social Security will be handled in their own right. In our view, there is no problem with Social Security financing. Social Security is fully funded for decades. We can deal with problems that might emerge decades later. In the future, we don't need to be either raising revenue now and certainly not cutting benefits now for problems that aren't going to take place for many years in the future. But if you were to make changes, you for sure would do the kind of things that you're talking about, which you would continue to tax well-off people for Social Security after they've made more than $100,000, whatever the cutoff is. You'd make it a more progressive system. You would not do what is being reported as being under consideration, which is to effectively cut benefits through this stealth maneuver.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Weissman, who is the president of the Public Citizen, a consumer advocacy group in Washington, D.C. And we're talking about rumors that the President Obama, in these negotiations over the so-called fiscal cliff, might be putting Social Security on the table, which is very hard to understand because it actually pays for itself. It's called an entitlement program, but people aren't entitled to it. They are entitled to it because they paid for it. I mean, the low-hanging fruit in terms of a driver in the deficit is the out-of-control health care costs. Maybe there's something, there's a reason to address that. There's no reason to address Social Security. And furthermore, there's also that other argument out there, not often expressed often enough, Robert Weissman, which is that the whole idea of the sky is falling over the deficits is in itself, not a lie and a gross exaggeration. Why is it that everybody in the world is rushing to buy American debt, and at the same time these politicians in Washington, particularly on the Republican side, are telling us the sky is falling and we're so deep in debt we can't get out of it? We can't be that much in debt that the rest of the world is rushing to buy our debt.
Yeah, I mean, we do have a political problem, and people should understand the fiscal the so-called fiscal cliff is a problem that would take place by cutting government spending too severely, not by causing too much spending, by raising taxes too suddenly. So the so-called fiscal cliff is really an acknowledgement of basic Keynesian economics, which is that in a time of ongoing recession, the government should be, in fact, spending a lot more than it's taking in. And the problem with the so-called fiscal cliff is that the government would stop doing that, or would do it to a lesser extent if no deal is negotiated. But on the broader issue that you're raising, apart from this immediate political crisis, you're exactly right. The concern about the deficit is entirely concocted by a handful of corporations and rich individuals who have invented a problem that does not exist, and therefore, along the way, are proposing solutions that would make this country more unequal, less just, and actually along the way would damage the economy. So not just the spreading of wealth, but actually reduce our overall wealth.
But the consequences of cutting Social Security, which, as I pointed out earlier, Robert Weissman, people who depend upon it have very few means. And what the great contribution Social Security has been to our society is that had it not existed, the elderly in this country would have been wards of the state or wards of their own children, which in turn would have bankrupted most wage earners in their middle age, if not in their youth. So its value goes beyond just taking care of the elderly. And if you take those meager gains away, you're going to impoverish a lot more people in this country. And that's really what it comes down to. Why do these social engineers on the right want to impoverish more of their fellow Americans?
Well, it's hard to say, but, you know, in some ways the more immediate question is, why is this being given serious consideration by the Obama administration? You are absolutely right. Cutting Social Security is both cruel and stupid. It's cruel because Social Security is our most important anti-poverty program, extraordinarily successful in reducing the rate of serious poverty among the nation's elderly. Not like they're doing great, because the benefits are really quite modest, but enough to take people out of poverty and to reverse the situation that we had prior to Social Security, which is widespread misery and impoverishment among the elderly, you know, one of the most vulnerable sections of society. And it's stupid because it's completely unnecessary as a financial matter. And even if we actually faced a Social Security financial crisis, which we do not, wouldn't we just say to ourselves, gosh, we're the richest country on the earth, we could spend a little bit more to take care of vulnerable elderly people. We certainly should say that. It's also extra stupid that such a proposal would be given consideration by the Obama administration, because it is, among many other things, politically a horrible idea. Social Security is extremely popular, not just among Democrats, but among Republicans. It's not just for old people, because every one of us is eventually going to be old and draw on Social Security. It is popular across all swaths of society, and it is just politically crazy to talk about cutting it. And, you know, and again, layered so, when there is absolutely no need to do it.
Well, the other possibility, and again, we are talking about speculation from leaks involved coming out of these negotiations between the White House and the Republicans, in particular between Obama and John Boehner, that the president may well cave on Social Security and allow Social Security to be recalibrated in terms of the cost of living adjustments, which would cost people, I think, 3% a year. But that, you know, over a decade, that starts to count. The other thing that supposedly the rumors are swirling around that the Obama administration may agree not to extend the payroll tax breaks that are scheduled to expire at year's end. What do you know about that, Robert Weissman?
Well, again, everything is rumor right now, and that will also be harmful. Now, that's a tricky issue, because the payroll tax breaks are not regular income tax payments. They're payments that are really due to Social Security. And the more and the longer we play the trick of not putting in money that's due Social Security and say, look, the government owes Social Security, the more we're making ourselves vulnerable to the inevitable argument that Social Security is underfunded, and no one really ever expected the government was going to pay the debts that it owes to the independent, separate Social Security Trust Fund. So the idea of this payroll tax cut is not a good long-term solution. But it is the case that if we eliminate it now, it's going to have a further recessionary impact on the economy. You know, I mean, again, I think the whole context of this is as you say, this need for new revenue is both imaginary and counterproductive in a time of Great Recession. But if you are looking for a lot of money, and for sure there are a lot of things the government ought, you know, the government should be raising more money to be doing many of the things that it's not doing that need to be done. There are a lot of places to look without stealing from the poor or the would-be poor. And, you know, one thing that we're highlighting is the possibility of imposing a financial speculation tax on Wall Street. If you did a very, very modest speculation tax, you can raise $350 billion over a 10-year period, according to conservative estimates. If you do a more aggressive tax, you can start getting the money up into the trillions. So there's just a lot of money to be had from Wall Street, which, of course, is the source of the Great Recession that we're now suffering from. So if you actually wanted to both raise money and take it from those most able to pay and those who plunged us into the current economic problems we're in, it's totally doable. You could impose a financial speculation tax.
I guess in a way, Robert Weissman, what makes a lot of people nervous and certainly makes me nervous is that the White House press spokesman, Jay Carney, said in reference to questions about where the fiscal cliff deal stands now, says we're not going to get everything we want. Why not? I mean, if he lets this mythical cliff happen and the ship of state goes over the so-called fiscal cliff, the automatic cuts that would take place are not the end of the world. It may well be the only way you'll ever cut the defense budgets. So I don't understand the need to concede when you hold all the cards.
Well, this has been an administration that's, you know, is very smart, but has been a very weak negotiator over the course of its first term. And I think people were pleased in the first couple weeks after the election with the unusual display of spine and negotiating savvy that was being displayed. And it may be that was just a mild couple-week interlude before it's back to the way things were, which, again, is exactly as you say, involves concessions, apparently, by a president who holds enormous leverage right now to House Republicans who do not. Concessions that will, you know, hit the most vulnerable among us, are politically foolish at best, and are going to have the impact of weakening an already very weak economy.
But I don't understand.
It's hard to get your head around it.
I know. And just in closing, though, I mean, I don't understand why you would want to reward the Republicans for finally conceding on the fact that the tax cuts for the rich have to expire, that they've had it too good for too long, and it's just not right. And so why reward them for coming to their senses, if indeed that's likely? This seems like a trade-off. To get them to come to their senses and not to and effectively get them off the hook, because politically they're getting more and more isolated and looking like whores for billionaires. So, I don't understand why you'd want to take this payroll tax hike or allow it to go back up again, which will, according to J.P. Morgan, which is one of the Wall Street people that that we're not too fond of, they're saying that the reduction in the payroll tax, removing the payroll tax cuts, will reduce U.S. disposable income by $125 billion. So you're taking money out of the pockets of the poor and the middle class just to satisfy the fact and to reward the Republicans for finally coming to their senses and not, you know, going to the mat for the billionaires.
Yeah, I mean, I think at this point what we have to hope for and work to make so is that these rumors are wrong, and that although these ideas are being floated, they don't really reflect where the administration is going to turn out and the concessions, if any, that they're ultimately going to make. But these stories aren't coming from nowhere, and there's this broader context, which gets back to what you were highlighting earlier, which is it appears that the president has basically bought into the idea that the biggest or one of the greatest challenges facing this country is the need to reduce the fiscal debt, the fiscal deficit. And if that's so, if he's actually believes that, then these kind of moves make some sense, and they foretell more dangerous and harmful moves that are likely to be coming in the next 2 years.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Robert Weissman.
Great to be with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Weissman, who's president of Public Citizen, a long-time consumer advocacy group in Washington, D.C. He's an expert on economics, healthcare, trade, and globalization, intellectual property and regulatory policy, and issues related to financial accountability and corporate responsibility. And he's worked to lower pharmacy prices for AIDS victims and others in the developing world. And his top priorities include climate change, healthcare reform, financial regulation, and campaign finance reform. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about hearings about to start in the United States Senate on the Congo, where 5 million people have died in a resource war.
It's a standard procedure. I forgot to mention that grandma's pension will ease the rent book tension. A little birdie told me you've been siphoning the poor box. I heard the knitting circle discussing job loss. What's all the commotion? What do they expect? No sign of a promotion. I lost my self-respect, you see.
And joining us now is George Zongola, who is professor of African and Afro-American Studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's the former president of the African Studies Association. Welcome to Background Briefing, George Zongola.
Thank you.
And just on Sunday, the New York Times carried a story saying that the Congo has become one of the bloodiest conflicts since World War II, with more than 5 million dead. It seems incomprehensible that the biggest country in sub-Saharan Africa, and on paper one of the richest, teeming with copper, diamonds, and gold, vast farmlands of spectacular fertility, and enough hydropower to light up the continent, is now one of the poorest, most hopeless nations on Earth. Why so, George?
Well, basically because of, first, poor leadership in the Congo that we haven't had. A leader who enjoys legitimacy, who is democratically elected and supported by the people, and who can provide the kind of governance we need in terms of strong institutions like a national army that can do its job. Secondly, external intervention, first by the neighboring countries, primarily Rwanda and Uganda, but also because these two countries are supported from the outside, namely by the United States and the United Kingdom.
Well, of course, the United States during the 60s got rid of the democratically elected government in the Congo and brought in Zeki Mobutu, who was one of the world's greatest kleptocrats, was he not?
Yes, one of the most corrupt leaders who led the country for over 30 years, ruining everything, and weakening the state and its institutions, yes.
So tell me about the various factions that are fighting in this civil war, who's backing them, and I guess at the end of the day, the DNA of so much of this has to do with who is getting these resources. I imagine things like coltan, which is necessary in all consumer electronic products, etc. So it's a murky mix, is it not, of economic motives, political manipulation, and there's a lot of people with blood on their hands, isn't there, George?
Yes. Well, the most important of the militia groups is the group calling itself the M23, or Movement of March 23. March 23 refers to March 23, 2009, when the government of Joseph Kabila, the current president of the Congo, signed an agreement of a group called the CNDP, the Congress a National Congress for Defense of the People. This is a group of Congolese Tutsi and Rwandan soldiers that were integrating the Congolese army, that were basically organized, trained, and armed by Rwanda to serve as the fifth column for Rwanda in the Congo. Their job is to facilitate access to Congolese resources by the government of Rwanda, which is exporting a lot of resources which Rwanda does not produce. And so today we see that the CNDP is no longer acting. We have a new group, the M23. This is a pattern that Rwanda has been using since 1996. This is the fourth group that Rwanda is using in order to destabilize Eastern Congo so they can have access to these resources.
Again, I'm speaking with George Zongola, who's a professor of African and Afro-American Studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and the former president of the African Studies Association and of the African Association of Political Science. His books include Revolution and Counter-Revolution in Africa and Nation Building and State Building in Africa. And George, Wednesday, the Armed Services Committee in the United States Senate are holding a hearing on the current situation in the Congo. Is there going to be anybody there present making the argument that you are making, which is that the United States is backing the very people who are destroying the Congo?
No, I looked at the people who are going to be testifying. I don't see anyone who can really make that argument. Fortunately, on the House side, the testimony of Mvembe Dizolele and Steve Higgy Tuesday of last week, these were extremely excellent testimonies, Mvembe being a Congolese and Steve Higgy being an American but whose parents were missionaries in the Congo and who has been the coordinator of the UN group of experts. This is a group that has provided us with very credible information on the involvement of Rwanda in arming the M23 in arming these militia groups in Eastern Congo. Unfortunately, on the Senate side, the announced hearing does not seem to be involving people who can really provide the kind of information that I'm providing you.
And are there any Congolese that are going to be testifying before the United States Senate on Wednesday?
No.
So what is the motive then? Why are the U.S. supporting the Rwandan regime of Paul Kagame and the Ugandan regime? And my understanding, a lot of this has to do with this Kony thing that happened on the YouTube, you know, this film made by these young American evangelicals that's affected U.S. policy and, in fact, I think is responsible for why the U.S. special forces are in that part of the world. Am I correct in that?
No, I would not use that as an argument. I think the matter is much more serious than that. What we're witnessing today is that instead of the Cold War with communism as enemy number one of the United States, today we have the so-called war on terror with international terrorism as the number one enemy of the United States. And today Rwanda and Uganda are the U.S.'s best allies in the Great Lakes region of Africa in a war against terror. Rwanda is providing one of the major military contingents and the commander of the UN African Union force in Darfur, in the Sudan, which is considered a country but is supporting Islamic terrorism. And Uganda is providing the most important unit of the African Union force in Somalia, helping to reestablish law and order in Somalia and fighting against the Al-Shabaab, the Somali militia group, which claims to be affiliated with Al-Qaeda. So this is why the United States is supporting these two countries as their best allies in the war against terror. Secondly, in the case of Rwanda, you have to remember the United States with its guilt complex. The guilt resulting from the fact that President Bill Clinton and Madeleine Albright, who was then the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations in 1994, did nothing to stop the genocide in Rwanda. As a matter of fact, United States compelled the United Nations to reduce the number of troops in Rwanda rather than increasing them. So Clinton finally went in to pronounce his mea culpa. And of course, since then, Clinton has been a strong supporter of the Rwandan regime, and the people who worked for him, including Susan Rice, the current U.S. ambassador to the U.N., who then served the first as in the National Security Council at the time, and later on became the Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, have been strong supporters of Mr. Kagame, the Rwandan dictator.
Well, you've given us a very good picture of the geopolitical motives in the war on terror, of who the United States is supporting and what they're getting out of it in this quid pro quo, particularly in Somalia. But the point I was trying to make, George, is that my understanding is that Joseph Kony, this warlord, is being used in effect as an excuse in the so-called war on terror to insert U.S. forces into that theater.
Well, it could be, but, 100 U.S. soldiers don't really...
That's true.
He could be useful, but I'm giving you the more important...
Right.
Reason.
Let's focus then on why it is that the U.S. Basically, the U.S. doesn't want to do anything except to go along with Paul Kagame's agenda, and as long as he's in there in the Congo, we're going to have this civil war. Is that the problem, that we simply are not on the side? We're not an honest broker because we're not backing an honest broker. I mean, the UN has a huge force in there, comparatively speaking. I think up to 20,000 troops. What the hell are they doing to stop this?
They are completely useless. And you have to remember, the United Nations in the Congo is led by an American diplomat, Roger Mees, a former U.S. ambassador to the Congo, a person who is a great supporter of Joseph Kabila, this useless young man who was put in power by Rwanda, Uganda, and Angola, with support of their backers in Washington, London, and elsewhere. So the UN is there. They have a mandate of peacekeeping, including the protection of civilians. And yet civilians are being killed, women and girls raped on a daily basis, and nothing is being done. So we have a very legitimate reason to ask, why does the international community spend $1.5 billion a year in supporting this UN peacekeeping mission in the Congo, when it is not doing the work it's supposed to be doing?
Well, surely the other question to ask George Zangola is, why are we blind to the fact that 5 million people have been killed, and we're backing people who are continuing the killing, and we have this fig leaf of a United Nations force in there that you say are absolutely useless? So somebody must be surely have told President Obama that millions of people are being killed, and women are raped every day, and children are murdered, and this is going on a daily basis. And even if you argue that maybe assuming that we are backing the right side, the question remains is, the killing continues, so something has to be done.
Exactly. That is an excellent question, one that should be asked of the Obama administration. For example, the United States, through AFRICOM, the African command of the U.S. Army, has trained a battalion of Congolese soldiers. And this battalion is supposedly trained for peacekeeping. And by peacekeeping, that means that they are not qualified to wage combat. And so when Rwandan troops invade the Congo, they cannot confront those troops to protect the Congolese people. So the question is, what is this peacekeeping all about? And so why is the United States so much interested in this proverbial peacekeeping while real human beings are being killed, are being harassed, and are being raped, and the natural rest of the Congo are being looted? So I think that these are some of the questions we American citizens have to raise in terms of the U.S. policy. Why are so many resources being looted when the real issue is issue of human rights, the issue of protecting people, the issue of democracy, an issue of peace?
Well, just in closing, George Zongola, we've heard about blood diamonds, and there have been an effort to shame Western consumers into being careful about what they purchase in terms of the origins. The same is true with cocoa. So why is it that we have coltan, which is used in most consumer electrics? You know, why don't we start a campaign that everybody that has an iPhone ought to be aware of the fact that they have blood on their hands because of these important rare earth minerals involved in electronics nowadays all come from the Congo, and the United States government is supporting a country that is both militarily occupying the Congo and prolonging the civil war, and is a conduit through which American business interests and Western business interests are extracting these minerals.
Yes, some non-government organizations have been making a campaign around blood minerals in the Congo. A group like the Enough Project, led by John Prendergast in Washington, student groups around the United States. But I think that all that is not sufficient. What is most important is two issues. First of all, militia groups. These resources are being produced, as I said, through forced labor and child labor under militia groups, which are using arms to compel people to get these resources and who oppress the populations in these mineral-rich areas. We have to destroy those militia groups. And the UN force in the Congo was called by African countries to come and deal with these so-called negative forces. If they're not doing that job, the UN should be given a mandate to help eradicate these militia groups. Secondly, the countries that are fueling this conflict are mostly Rwanda and Uganda. They have to be punished by international community. There is a law in the United States which was first introduced by Senator Obama and supported by Senator Hillary Clinton, now called the Obama Law, which states that countries interfering in Congolese affairs and looting Congolese resources are to be punished. Right now, little has been done to punish Rwanda and Uganda for their transgressions. So I think that if those two things are done, that would provide a opportunity for the Congolese to be able to organize themselves and create institutions that would deal with questions of law and order and protection of civilians in eastern Congo.
Well, George Zongola, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with George Zongola, who is a professor of African and Afro-American Studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and the former president of the African Studies Association and of the African Association of Political Science. His books include Revolution and Counter-Revolution in Africa and Nation Building and State Building in Africa. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me, and I'll answer your questions as best I can. The conversation continues at facebook.com/IanMastersMedia, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.